during the last interview, we spoke about the various halachas of shechita, the five halachas of shechita, and now I'd like to address briefly another aspect of shechita. In what position should the animal ideally be in during the shechita? There are many different positions. For one, we could have the animal lying on its back with the neck exposed and just beneath the knife of the shechit, who stands above the animal and moves the knife back and forth as he's cutting through the simonim, the windpipe, and the food pipe. In the ancient world, I believe that there was a shechita, a position slightly different from this, where the animal was laying on its side, and the shechit twisted its neck slightly upwards so that the shechita was delivered at an angle, with the simonim tilted a little bit to the side and a little bit upwards. These shechitas are known popularly as shechita munachas, where the animal is laying on the ground or laying on a table or some other type of device which keeps the animal on its back. And the shechit is shechting in a back and forth motion, but downward from an upper position towards the earth. It's possible to have the animal standing. That's called shechita oimedes. And this is a very common form of shechita today. The animal stands on its four legs. And there are restraints. He's in a little box, which is called a pen. The head is sticking out through a little window. And there's something that supports the belly of the animal, another block that presses down on its back, another one that pushes it from behind so that the animal is totally immobilized. And the head is kept in place through a U-bar, a bar shaped like a U, which is raised upwards so that the neck could be fully exposed. Here, the position of the shechit is not quite upwards, but it's angled slightly upwards because the neck is not facing downward, nor is it facing upward, but it's tilted, and the motion of the shechit's hand is towards the back of the neck, which is slightly higher than the front of the neck. There are places where the animal is swung from a restraint which is higher, it's held by its legs, and the head is lower. There are restraints which keep the animal fixed in a certain position, and the shechit again shechts with most of the animal upward. This is called shechita tluya. The animal is hanging, but being held fast and firm so that it shouldn't move during the shechita. In all three cases, the knife is being moved by the shechit back and forth. And when it goes away from him, it's called a hailocha. And when the knife is pulled back towards the shechit, it's called a hayvor. And by doing hailocha vayvor once or twice, and even three times, depending on the size of the neck by a very, very large animal, it may take a number of motions back and forth to complete the hailochas and hayvors necessary to cut through the simonim. Which form of shechita is more preferable? In truth, all three are equally acceptable in halacha. The Rambam says, "Keitzat shechten, how do you shecht? Hoisa habehema oimedes oy revutza. The behema could be lying down on the ground, that's revutza, or standing on its legs in oimedes. The only thing necessary to have in each of the three cases is that the behema should be immobilized so that it shouldn't jump or shake from side to side, and that would of course disqualify the shechita, because then you're not sure that you have a back and forth motion which shechita must conform to, It may result in a little drosso, which is a slicing action straight towards the neck from the outside, which is one of the five psulim in shchita, which is unacceptable. Now, there have been debates among rabbonim over the generations as to which one of the shchitas is preferable, because of diyukim, which means a careful reading into the words and details of statements made by various poskim, which seem to indicate one way or the other. But the truth is that any of these is equally acceptable. This is the opinion of the major poskim who dealt with Hilchos Shchita and whose word is always accepted, such as the Tvur Shoyer, who wrote the Sefer Simla Chadosha, and there he carefully states that all methods are equally acceptable, and the opinion of all major poskim. And so custom had the position for the behema, the animal, vary from country to country, and although it could be debated among rabbonim and among shochtim, the main thing is to see that the animal is totally immobilized and that the motion of the knife is back and forth, and the shochet is free to move the knife as he pleases, and it's not the motion of the head of the animal that causes the shchita to take place, which would mean that the knife would be held fast in a fixed position and the neck of the animal slid back and forth. That is definitely not a preferable way to make shchita, although in many cases it's acceptable. In the case of birds, too, there's various ways of making tvisa. That is, the shochet holds the bird between the fingers of his left hand and exposes the neck and moves the simonim into a position which is most favorable to shchita. And then, with the knife held deftly in his right hand, the bird is held fast by the left hand and the knife is moved freely and easily back and forth, and the required shchita is performed. If the shochet feels during the shchita that something went wrong and that the animal perhaps gave a lurch and might have moved during the shchita, the shochet will always declare that animal or bird to be an avela, and it would be taken off the line and marked very specially. This animal is an avela, it didn't have the proper shchita, and it would be sold to non-Jews and processed separately from the others. Now, once the shchita is over, of course, we're not finished with the processing of the animal at all. First, the animal is lifted up, and they go through a bleeding to see that most of the blood comes pouring out of the open blood vessels, the arteries and the veins, which were cut through. And this it's left in such a position for a minute, perhaps, so that the animal stops thrashing about and the blood is gone. And, of course, it's much better for the meat. The meat sometimes becomes suffused with blood and it's bloodshot and it practically can't be eaten at all. So you have to seek to allow for adequate bleeding, and the coming to rest of the thrashing about of the animal. While it thrashes about, it's called mefarcheses. To see that the animal jumps about is definitely something that we prefer, rather than an animal that becomes insensate and just stops moving immediately, because that would indicate that there was something wrong, the animal was dying. And if we had seen before the shchita that the animal is so weak that it practically can't get up on its feet, we call that animal a misukenes. And when we shecht it, we have to carefully monitor and watch to see that it thrashes about slightly after the shechita is completed. If not, so we suspect that the animal might have died in the middle of the shechita. As it is, even if the animal still thrashed for a few seconds after the shechita, and it's considered acceptable, but a very God-fearing person, a tzaddik, should not eat from that animal. Just as we find in the Sefer Yecheskel, that Yecheskel Hanavi said to Hashem that I have not eaten from an animal that it's an emergency to shecht because it's about to die, and that was considered a schus for himself, and he pleaded with Hashem for a certain thing on the basis of that special schus. Now, after the shechita and after the stilling of the animal is complete, then the skin is removed, and the animal is held in a hanging down position with the neck on the bottom and the hind legs on top, and then they begin dismembering the animal. What does that mean? It means to make a slit down the abdomen and remove the innards, which are the stomachs. The animal has four stomachs and the intestinal system, the liver, and the other internal organs that are in the lower chamber of the animal. Now, let me describe the animal briefly, because I'm going to tell you about what we have to examine the animal for. This examination is called a bedika, and it's extremely important to make a proper examination of the animal to search for any possible signs of a trefa. The structure of an animal, as you know, that there are four legs that hold up the torso of the animal. In the front, there's solid flesh, the head and the shoulders, and four legs in the front. All the way in the back, there's the thigh, the hind part of the quarters of the animal, and the tail. And in between, there's a big space. It's housed by the ribs on top, by the abdominal wall on bottom and on the sides. And there are two chambers, sort of two rooms inside the animal. And they're separated by the diaphragm. The diaphragm is called Yoseres HaKoved, according to most authorities, and it's mentioned in the Torah. It's one of the sections that went onto the Mizbeach in the case of a Korban Shlomim and similar Korbanos. This diaphragm is the wall that separates the front room from the back room. In the front room, there are mainly two important organs. One is the lung, and one is the heart. The lung and the heart are the main occupants of the fore chamber, the front chamber, the upper chamber, nearest to the head. We call that the cranial section of the animal. That's the technical word to mean the front part. The back part is called the caudal, C-A-U-D-A-L, the caudal section of the animal. The food pipe runs through this section, so it also is a guest in the chamber of the lung and the heart. And all the food passes tightly encased in the food pipe, and it goes through an opening in the diaphragm, and it goes to the back section. The processing of the food takes place in the back section. There are four stomachs. A kosher animal, which is ruminating, does the following. The food, the grasses, and the other highly unprocessed food go into a large chamber, which is called the keres, or the rumen in English, and there it stays for a couple of days, and little microorganisms cause a rotting of the cellulose-filled grasses, and they break down the long chains of carbohydrates, which are indigestible, into much tinier pieces, so that they could be chewed up and ripped apart and prepared for digestion. After sitting in the first chamber, the keres, and the softening and rotting, it's now ready to slip into the second chamber, which is a little lower. That second chamber is called the Beis HaKoisos, the House of the Cups. The inside lining of this chamber has little cups covering every part of the inner surface. And the muscles of the Beis HaKoisos squeeze the chamber and push the food back into the food pipe. And the food pipe then squeezes the food in little balls called kud, or geira in Lashon Kodesh, and they go up, reverse peristalsis, that's what it's called, and it goes back to the mouth. Here the animal chews up the food using its hind teeth, the molars, and it doesn't eat any new grass during this time, because the whole time it chews and chews and chews, which would be impossible when the grass was complete. The chewing would accomplish nothing. But now that it's rotted, it could chew it, fill it with the enzymes in the mouth, and make it into a more liquidy food. And then when it's ready, it swallows this prepared food, already thoroughly chewed, and it goes again down the food pipe a second time. And there, in a complex system of valves, it's shifted over to the third chamber, which is called the Hemsis. It's called the Omesum, and in English. The Beis HaKoisos, the lining of the Beis HaKoisos is a delicacy to certain people. It's called honeycomb tripe, by the way. That's the cups that cover the inside of the Beis HaKoisos. From the Hemsis, it goes into the fourth chamber, which is shaped like a bow, an archery bow. And in this fourth chamber is where the real digestion takes place. The acids and the enzymes work on the food, which is already rotted and softened and chewed and partially liquefied. And in this soup of beneficial chemicals, it begins to be broken down into very, very tiny particles, and these particles are broken apart chemically into simple carbohydrates and simple sugars and amino acids, which are the breakdown of the proteins. And from there, when it's all done, they pass through the valve that empties out the food into the duodenum, that's called the pylorus, and it goes through the an arch that takes it to the top of the second chamber, and there the two organs empty their enzymes and their fluids into the intestine. The liver empties its bile into the intestine, and the pancreas empties its beneficial enzymes, the trypsin, which digests proteins, and the lipase, which digests fats, and the amylases, which digest sugars and starches, and also the insulin gets injected into the intestine at this point, and then the food goes on, filled with all these beneficial chemicals, and it travels through the small intestine. It goes through the ultimate breakdown until the parts are ready now to be absorbed into the bloodstream, and it brings life and nourishment to the animal. And when all this food is extracted from the material, then the liquid is absorbed back into the bloodstream. It's recycled, as it were, and the waste is ejected from the body. This is the general structure of the hind chamber, the caudal chamber, the lower chamber of the animal. Now, there are a lot of defects that could possibly occur in many of these organs. The heart and the lung and the various parts of the intestines, which would render it trefa. We don't examine the animal for all the rare trefas, and we rely on the majority of cases, roiv, and we say that we could assume that there is no trefa in most of the organs. And we only examine carefully those parts of the animal where trefas are commonly found. Now, the examination is done in the following way. As the animal is hanging down and the abdominal wall is split open, the intestine and various stomachs and the liver are all removed very carefully, and now the diaphragm is exposed, and the shochet could see the entire diaphragm in front of him. Now he makes two slits in the diaphragm, one on the right side, one on the left side. And he puts his hand into each of these slits, and he could feel his way around the lung heart chamber, the chest cavity, the thoracic cavity, which is in the cranial forward part of the animal. His fingers moved very deftly and skillfully all around the various lobes of the lung. The lung has eight lobes, eight special sections, five on the side, three in the right and two on the left, two major ones in the caudal part of the lung, the end part of the lung, and one in the forward part in the belly of the lung, which is called the inuniso de vardo. And it's possible, and it indeed happens in many cases, that there are lesions. There's pieces of tissue which connect the different lobes of the lung one to another. These are called sirchos, and they have to be carefully examined. There are sirchos that connect the lung to the upper wall of the animal, the dyphen, the flesh between the ribs, or the ribs themselves. There are lesions that connect the parts of the lung to anything, to the heart or to some internal organs, to the diaphragm. There are all kinds of sirchos, thin ones, thick ones, some shaped like ribbons, some shaped like threads, some fleshy and fat, some very thin, some that fall apart to the touch. The shochet has to go through a rigorous training period. Actually, I shouldn't use the word shochet. It's usually the shochtim that are skilled in these things. But he's actually performing as a boydek, not as a shochet. And while the lung is in its original position, he feels around all the different parts to see where the different sections of the lung may be connected through sirchos to each other or to the other parts of the animal. He does it on the right, he does it on the left, and he makes a careful note of each sircha, if there are any, and he has a diagram and draws a mark here and a mark there to show where the position of the sircha that he discovered is. He makes a careful note of it, and he gives this over to the second boydik, who's going to make an examination after the lung is removed, a visual examination, not a hidden examination. The first bedika that we described is called bedikas pnim. It's done blindly through feeling while the lung is inside. Pnim means inside its chamber in its natural position. After this is done, then the sternum, which is the bone connecting the right group of ribs from to the left group of ribs, the front, the chest bone, that's cut open thoroughly, and the lung and the heart are removed. And then the lung is put onto a little table, and it's examined visually and externally. Not internally, but externally. Bedikas chutz. That's what it's called. And the one who makes a bedikas chutz will almost certainly inflate the lung, to have a good examination of all the surfaces of the lung, he might find a little sircha, which is not on the map that the Boydik Pnim showed him. He might check through the sirchas of the Boydik Pnim, but in his expertise, he's very, very careful, checks through every little spot in the lung, and is able to notice anything that's a variation from the norm, from the natural appearance of the lung. There could be infections, abscesses, tubercles, which are an indication of tuberculosis. There could be changes in color, shinui mara, of all different kinds affecting the lung. He's able to determine if there's any trefa problem, if there's a suspicion of any type of damage to the lung, a hole in the lung. And he has to take a look at every little thing and decide if this animal is trefa and it has to be rejected, or if it's a ksheira. Because of the extreme care and caution in making this examination, we find that more than half the animals are usually rejected, maybe 55% or even 60%. Sometimes in a very good lot of animals, there's much less than that rejected. But because of the examination, quite a few animals are removed and they're considered trefa. They're marked as such. And they're shifted over to a different section of the slaughterhouse, and where they're processed away from the food that's kosher. The hindquarters of the animal are not used, at least in this country, at all, and I'll explain to you why in a moment. There's one other section of the animal that's examined. It's examined quickly, just by looking at it, perhaps touching it, and that is the Beis HaKosis, the second of the four stomachs. The reason is because the Beis HaKosis acts as a trap, like you have under the sink, and anything which might go into the drainage system is caught by the trap and just remains there. The Beis HaKosis is the trap that holds nails and hairballs and all kinds of indigestible material, which is swallowed by the animal. It's caught in the Beis HaKosis and sometimes remains there. And when an iron nail is inside of a piece of flesh, it often rips through the lining of it and causes bleeding. And sometimes the internal bleeding is extensive, and sometimes the nail could even penetrate the outside. In all these cases, we reject the animal because we say that it's a trefa, it has a hole, it has damage to the walls of the Beis HaKosis. Any organ, in truth, of the hindquarters could be found to be trefa. But as I said before, it's pretty unusual to find damage to an internal organ other than the ones that I mentioned before, the lung and the Beis HaKosis. And by the way, the Beis HaKosis is called the reticulum in English. So we have the Hebrew names of the four stomachs, the keres, followed by the Beis HaKosis. Then go back to the mouth and coming back down again after being chewed, followed by the omasum, and the cave of the fourth stomach, the abomasum. Abomasum means near the omasum. In Lashon Kodesh, it's the keres, the Beis HaKosis, the hemsis, and the cave. Now, after these examinations are made, then the animal is marked very carefully. The shoichet, that is the boydik pnim, who's standing and being boydik, the second and third and fourth animal, and by the time he's finished, he gets the report from the the Boidek Chutz as to whether the Boidek Chutz passed the previous animals, and whenever the report comes in, and both the Bedikas Pnim and the Bedikas Chutz show that the animal is kosher, no further Bedikas is made, and the Shechet, or the Boidek, goes over to the animal and marks it. He usually does two markings. He has a paint, purple paint, which is put onto the inside of the rib cage, and it's marked as being kosher. Then he takes out a knife and makes two, three slashes. One of them, which will show which week it is, he uses the name of the seder. And let's say, for instance, it's Shemois, so he'll take three lines joined at the bottom, looking somewhat like a shin. Or if it's Boy or Beshalach, he'll do something to indicate a Beis, and or a Beis followed by a shin, Beshalach. And he'll also write another letter before it, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Vav, which means the day of the week that it was Geshachten. The Gimel Shin would be Tuesday, Parshas Beshalach. And he makes the cut in the skin of the rib cage. Now, it's interesting. This cut is called a hot cut. And if it's made later, long after the animal is returned to the cooler, then if a similar cut is made, it would be called a cold cut. Don't confuse that with salami and pastrami, which we call commonly cold cuts. This hot cut and cold cut is very important, because if the animal is still warm while the cut is made, so the skin shrinks back, and the few lines indicating that Gimel, Shin, or whatever letters you have, widen. You don't have straight lines, thin cuts, but each one becomes wide and oval, so that they look much differently than the cut that produced them at the time the cut was made. And it's because the warmth of the flesh that it expands, it's called a hot cut. It can't be reproduced if a cut is made to put these letters into the animal after it cooled. And we always suspect that some finagling like this could possibly have happened, then it would look completely different. It would just be slits, and you could see instantly that it was done when the meat was cold. So it's a guarantee that no one could take a trefna animal and market it as if it was kosher. It's another one of the careful simonim that we use to ensure that animals that are treif were not mixed into the ones that are kosher or wrongly labeled. After this, the hindquarters are removed, as I said before, and the animal is brought to the cooler, and it hangs there for about 12 hours till all the warmth is gone from the animal. The next work that has to be done to the animal is called nikur. In Yiddish, we call that trebring. And I think that we covered quite a bit in the discussion of shchitu menachas and oimedes, and followed by bedikas, that it would be preferable to leave a full discussion on nikur for another time. And so I'll take leave of the discussion on meat. But up to this point, you could easily see how much work goes into the preparation of a kosher meat. But we're definitely not finished with the discussion, and have at least one or two more sessions to complete it. Thank you very much.